Just want to remind you that John is the person who essentially invented EFTs for gravity, so it's kind of a treat to have him here. And tonight there will be the dinner, so it's kind of a busy day, and so we should start.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Today I'm going to talk about the so-called non-abelian topological quantum order theory. So basically, for all these previous lectures, we discussed some basic notion about abelian anions, in particular for the Z2 topological order, right, in the context of K-tile torical as a simple example. Yeah, so it turns out those abelian anions, they can provide some very good usage to, say, encode quantum information that is robust to some local perturbation, right? So in that sense, it is a very good topological quantum memory. But somehow, it is less powerful in the sense that you can remember, if you consider some K-tile torical model, right? If you create two anions, and if you bred them like locally, right? It only give you a phase. And that phase won't do anything non-trivial for the ground state subspace, for the logical information you encode. So somehow, you need to do something more powerful. And it turns out this non-abelian anion is very useful for quantum computing, because there, if you really bred two non-abelian anions, that operation can be regarded as some unitary operation. So it adds non-trivially for the information you encode. Yeah. Yeah, so, and my goal here today is not to give you the most complete story, but instead I'll give you some simple example where you can see those are emergent anions in some simple model. So in particular, I'll focus on the so-called icing anion theory. So there are three types of, emergent or quasi-particles, anions. So those are three kind of different quasi-particles here. And this is the conventional notation. So basically, this one, is just you can imagine, it's just a vacuum, so kind of trivial particle, the ground state, for example. And there's a sigma. You can imagine, in the context, it behaves like a Mariana fermions. And this epsilon behave like a complex fermion. Yeah, in particular, they satisfy some fusion rules. Yeah, so roughly speaking, this just means that if you had two fermions, you can easily annihilate into a vacuum, right? Or you can read it as another way. Starting from the vacuum, you can only create pairs of fermions. And the second thing is if you have a fermion and a Mariana fermion, then you can fuse them together to get another Mariana fermion. And finally, which is the most important thing, yeah, when you put two Mariana fermions together, right, then there are two possible outcomes, basically. So let's label by 1 plus epsilon. So basically, when you have two Mariana fermions together, that can be regarded as a complex fermion. But basically, if you think about complex fermion, it's a two-state system, right? You can either fill that single particle mode or not, right? So there are two possibilities. So this guy is like, there's no occupied fermion. And this is then there's a complex fermion, starting from these two Mariana operators. Yeah, we're gonna see more example here, so yeah, just bear with me for this moment. So again, we're going to use some simple example, and it is so-called Kitaya Haruko model. So again, Kitaya invented too many good things. So if you talk about Kitaya model, then no one knows which one you are talking about. He has too many toy models, which has many, you know, rich physics. Yeah, so Haruko model. So for this, let's consider, as the name suggests, let's consider some Haruko lattice. Yeah. Imagine you draw some honeycomb lattice in 2D. And one thing you can notice is there are three possible orientations. There are three possible directions for the link, right? So I label this direction to be the X link, and this direction to be the Y link, and this direction to be the Z link. All right, so there are three types of orientation in this honeycomb lattice. And right now, let me consider for every vertex, I put a qubit. Yeah, so maybe most precisely, let me say spin 1/2 for every vertex in the lattice. Yeah, and right now, right, so let me write down the Hamiltonian for this model. All right, so there are three types of sums, but the first term is given by the product of poly X, the excess interaction between neighboring spins. So basically, as you can see here, there are three types of orientation. So right now, when I write down the first term, it basically means that I cannot sum over all the local terms along the X direction. So for example, given my notation there, the X link is this kind of link, right? So basically, the first term means that the neighboring spin will have this, for example, this guy, we're going to interact with this guy using the two-body interaction, spin-spin interactions. Yeah, and there's an independent JX coupling constant. And similarly, we can assign the interaction in different directions. So this is the poly, you know, YY interaction between spin 1/2. Yeah, so this is how you write down the model. So it's a very simple looking model, right? It's just the neighboring spin-spin interactions, but the interaction depends on the orientation of the link, yeah? And there are three types of link, right? Yeah, so I guess the first thing to notice is, so right now every term do not commute anymore, right? So it's different from the simple Toriko model. But one feature you can notice is that there are some frustration between spins. Frustration in the sense that they are gonna, different orientation are gonna compete with each other, right? For example, if you consider a single spin here, a single spin 1/2. So along here, you're gonna have the XX interaction, right? The XX interaction between this guy and this guy. And for this guy, you're gonna have a YY interaction between this spin and this spin, right? And here, for the vertical link, you're gonna have the ZZ interaction, right? Yeah. So if you look at this guy, it's very confusing for this guy to see what you're gonna do, right? Because you're gonna already, you try to, you know, couple this guy, try to align with this guy along the X direction. But this guy try to align with this guy with the Y direction, and this guy try to align with this guy, you know, in the Z direction. So you also can see here, there are some interesting frustration. And that is the reason why, kind of the intuition why the ground state can support some interesting quantum order. The reason being, there are some frustration, so this guy, if you choose any particular direction, then that spin will not be happy, right? So one way to get around that is that you superpose many different things to form some massive superpositions. So that's kind of the reason why this ground state can have some interesting quantum order. Yeah. All right, so even though the local term do not commute with each other anymore, but somehow there are some hidden conserved charges or conserved quantity you can use to solve the model. And that's very nice. So let's specialize to some particular plaquette, the honeycomb. So certainly there are six spins here. Let me label by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah. You find that locally, you can define a plaquette operator. Let me write down the result and I will explain later. So if you consider some local plaquette in the Harlingen lattice, right, it turns out you can define this kind of operator. It's the product of an operator around this plaquette. Yeah, it's a six-body interaction. And this guy will commute with every local term in the Hamiltonian. So that's very nice. And there are, and because the plaquette location is everywhere, right, so there are extensive number of conserved charges or conserved quantity. And that's going to help you to solve this model. And maybe a nicer way to write down is to write down this is when you consider some link. Let me define another operator, say Kij, and it can take three possible values. Let me just introduce a single operator, Kij, and that can be like XX, YY, or ZZ interaction, depends on what is the orientation of this IJ link. Yeah? And one good way to write down this guy is it can be written by like K12, K33, K34, K45. Yeah. So it is simply the product of an interacting term in the Hamiltonian. And if you form a product, then that is a conserved charges. Or let me write down this way. It's the product of an interaction around this plaquette. So as I advertised before, this is a conserved charges. It's gonna conserve, it's gonna commute with every local term in Hamiltonian, right? So right now, let's see how it happened. So for example, let's look at the first spin here. So we know that this guy is gonna connect to some spin here, right? And there's an XX interaction. And you, for example, you may check whether they commute or not. And because when you assign the first, this operator, there's an X1 here. So there's a poly X operator down here, right? So that commute with this guy. So it commute with the orientation along X, right? That's the first thing you can notice. And the second thing is, all right, yeah, so it's maybe kind of trivial. So right now, let's consider the interaction between these two. And the local term is given by, this is a Z orientation link, right? So there's gonna be some ZZ interaction, say Z2, Z1. Yeah? And then you find that, okay, you can start the computation relation between this, the product of Z's and this plaquette operator, right? And you find that, okay, X1 end up coming with Z1, so you get a minus sign, minus one sign. But then the Y2 also end up coming with a Z2. Yeah. So totally, the WP will commute with this interaction here. Yeah. So this WP is kind of perfectly designed to commute with everything here. And because of asymmetry between different directions, so if you know the ZZ commute with that guy, then the different interaction term will also commute with this operator. Yeah, this you can check. But this is a nice property that you have some conserved quantity and that can help you to solve this model. Yeah. So we know that this parquet operator commutes with
Dieter?
Yeah.
Sorry, just one small confusion. In WP, in the first line, you have X, Y, Z. And in the second one, it seems that to me that you have X, X, Y, Y, Z, Z. The Ks are quadratic in the...
Oh, sorry, is for the first line. Are you good with the first line? So it's the X, Y, Z, X, Y, Z. So it's X, Y, Z, X, Y, Z.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the second, if I look at the definition of the Ks, are they quadratic in the X?
Mm-hmm. Right. And so let's try to understand why they are equal. So for example, you can look at operator at 2. So there's overlap between these two guys. Say K1, 2, K2, 3.
Oh, you commute.
And you try to... So that means that K1, 2 is basically the Z1, Z2, right? And K2, 3 is the... given by the XX. So it's like X1,
oh, I see.
X2, okay. S3.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you do the product between these two operators, you get the Y2. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So kind of very nicely designed property. Yeah. Yeah.
Z1, Z2. Maybe I'm confused with the definition of Kij.
Mm-hmm.
So Kij is when will it be XX, when will it be YY, when will it be ZZ?
Yeah, so when IJ link is in the X orientation,
you're gonna
choose that to be the XX
iteration.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. So different orientation give you different.
Got it.
Yeah,
Got it.
It's just a shorthand notation.
So the Ks are essentially those entering the H, the Hamiltonian.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, so given this definition for this parquet operator, WP operator, you know, it commutes with every term in the Hamiltonian. And the different parquet operators, they also commute with each other. So that means we have some, let me just write down. We have extensive conserved quantities because the number of parquets scale with the volume of the system. So that means when you try to solve for this Hamiltonian, try to solve for this model, right? The Hilbert space can split into different sectors. Because, so let me just write down the slogan here. Yeah, so the Hilbert space for the entire system can be split into different sectors, where each sector corresponding to some particular configuration for this WP operator, right? Yeah. Also, you notice that, this is the spectrum for this operator is 1 or minus 1, right? It's square to 1. So that is a nice property we're going to use later. So right now, let's consider a question. For a given configuration of the WP operator value, what is the size of the Hilbert space dimension in that subspace? Yeah, so say you have n number of lattice sites, number of vertices is equal to n. Then you just need to count what is the dimension, also what is the number of a parquet operator, right? And that will be equal to n over 2. And this is the number of WP operator. Yeah. So the number of lattice sites is the twice of the number of WP operator. And one quick way to see that is for a given operator, for a given location of the P, you may associate these two sites belong to this P, the parquet, right? So for every single P, you may associate with two sites. For every single P, you may associate with this two sites. So the number of lattice sites is simply the twice of the number of WP operator, right? Yeah. So the dimension of the subspace is given by 2 to the n. 2 to the n is the total Hilbert space dimension, right? Because they are n spin 1/2. And you need to subtract it by 2 to the n over 2. Yeah? Because whenever you specify the value of a parquet operator, you reduce the dimension by divided by 2, right? So you divide it by 2 to the number of a parquet operator. And what you find is that it's 2 to the n over 2, which is also equal to square root of 2 to the power of n. So roughly speaking, that means that in the ground state subspace, right, or in any subspace of with these conserved charges, the dimension is square root over to the power of n. So roughly speaking, it suggests something kind of interesting. It is the Hilbert space of n number of single Majorana fermions. So basically, you could imagine like the single Majorana fermion has that quantum dimension square root 2, because you need to put 2 Majorana fermions to form a complex fermion, right? So this kind of count kind of suggests that there are some underlying description in terms of Majorana fermions for this Hamiltonian. Yeah, and right now this is what we're gonna do. We are gonna solve for the Hamiltonian in terms of this Majorana fermions. So at the first glance, it may be surprising because, all right, so you start from some spin model, right? So where that Majorana fermion come from? But I guess that is the interesting part in this quantum matter study, right? Because there are different kind of emergence particles, and that is very different from the underlying ingredient for the many-body system, right? And especially that already happened for the torical, right? Because you start from some spin 1/2, you assign some weird intention among different qubits, then you can emerge some interesting anions and even fermion, right? So this emergence of different quasi particles is kind of interesting feature for this kind of interesting topological order state.
Peter, could you just explain in a bit more detail why the square root 2 gives the hint of it being a Majorana?
Oh, because a single Majorana fermion, the quantum dimension is square root 2. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Clausius intuition is the say I have gamma 1, gamma 2. These are the Majorana operators, meaning that gamma I is greater than 1, and gamma I dagger is equal to gamma I. And gamma 1, gamma 2 is equal to minus gamma 2, gamma 1. These are the definition for Majorana operators, right? And using this, you can form a complex fermion. Say F is equal to you can form a complex fermion, right? And you know that, okay, starting from the vacuum, you may try to you can try to occupy that single particle mode or not. So there are two possibilities, right? Yeah. Starting from the vacuum of this fermion, you can either stay in the vacuum where there's no fermion occupied, and or you can consider this fermion creation operator acting in the vacuum. So you get two state system, right? And by this F, we mean it's a complex fermion. Yeah, because it's a complex thing, right? So there are two possibilities, right? Depends on whether you want to occupy it or not. So it's a two-state system. So in that sense, if you had two, it is like the dimension of the gamma 1 is square root 2, and the dimension of the gamma 2 is also square root 2. So like when you tensor product them together, you multiply the total Hilbert space dimension is the product of the individual dimension, right? And then you get two-dimensional superspace. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why people kind of code the quantum dimension for Majorana fermion as square root 2.
So this quantum dimension is the square root of how many levels you have?
Quantum dimension is just a square root 2.
What is that number, quantum dimension?
Oh, it basically means that when you put, when you say, that basically means that, all right, let me put it this way. If you consider a qubit, what is the dimension for a qubit? It's 2, right? Mm-hmm. The reason being?
Yeah, that's clear. That's clear.
Yeah. And then it's the same logic for the Majorana fermions. You can ask, if you consider many different Majorana fermions together, what is the dimension of Hilbert space you can form? Mm-hmm. The answer is equal to this guy.
Literally that sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ah, that's a good question. So actually, it's a big hand waving, so it's kind of substituted by all the one number offset. Yeah, but let's forget about that right now. Yeah, but it's a good question. Yeah, only when can you consider a periodic boundary condition, then you can get some degeneracy in the ground state. Yeah, but that's right. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we are just gonna follow Kitai's original solution to try to solve for this model. And because the reason I'm saying this is because there are many different ways to solve for this model. But we are gonna follow original solution by Kitai. Yeah, so say we consider some particular size I. So there's a spin 1/2. And then we are gonna split this spin 1/2 particle into smaller pieces. So I'm gonna split this spin 1/2 operator into different pieces, in particular four different Majorana fermions. Yeah, and let me be clear about this. So Let me just write down these are the Marrella fermions. Yeah. And actually, I just mentioned, but let me still write down what do I mean by Marrella fermions. So you have gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, gamma 4. When you say they are Marrella, you mean gamma I squared is square to 1. And when you take a derivative of the operator, it comes back to itself. Yeah. And also, I guess this is the reason why people call Marrella has its antiparticle, even though I don't know what that means. If you, yeah, it's a very vague statement, but that basically means this, when you take a derivative of the operator, it is invariant, right? And of course, because it is some fermions, so they have some algebra like gamma I, gamma j is equal to, you get a minus sign when you exchange two fermions. Yeah, so for example, when you say gamma 1, gamma 2, then that will be equal to minus gamma 2, gamma 1. Yeah, when you exchange two things, you get a minus sign. That's the Fermionic statistics. Yeah. And also, based on this Marrella fermion, you can form two complex fermions. So those are the complex fermions. And they satisfy the conventional algebra for complex fermion, which you are familiar with. Yeah, for example, Fi, Fj, the anti-commutator is equal to delta ij. Yeah, these are the familiar Fermionic algebra. All right, so when I mean I can split a spin 1/2 into four different Marrella fermions, I need to specify what is the operator mapping, right? What is the, how do you write down some spin operator in terms of this Marrella operator, right? Yeah, and this is the answer here. So X, the Pauli X operator acting on the spin 1/2 can be split into I, which is the imaginary unit, times BX times C. Yeah, so it is like the Pauli X operator is equal to the product between these two. And kind of it's kind of designed to, so that the X is the product along this direction, right? Which is consistent with the original definition for orientation for the lattice. And similarly, the y operator is given by this, and the z operator is I, B, Z, C. Yeah, so you can identify the spin operator in terms of these Marrella fermions, and as you can check, they satisfy the Pauli algebra, right? For example, you can check whether xy is equal to yx or not. Yeah. And yeah, and you can see the reason because when you consider x times y, you get bxc times byc, right? And you are gonna flip these two things from the right-hand side to the left-hand side. So imagine you could move this by from here to here, right? And because there are two Marrella fermions here, so you're gonna get a sign which is minus 1 to the square, right? If you first move this by operator. Yeah? And right now you're gonna exchange these two positions, right? with a minus sign. Yeah, because when I flip, when I exchange these two positions, I get a minus one sign. Yeah. So you see here, so the product of this guy satisfies the Pauli algebra here. Yeah, and you can do the same thing for, let's say, different orientations, say YZ or ZX. Yeah, it's your choice. Yeah, but on the single side, that satisfies the conventional Pauli algebra. And for the two sides, say IJ, meaning the spin one half at different sites, then of course we know that based on the spin operator, they should commute with each other, right? Because they are the bosonic spin. And as you can check, XI, YJ is equal to YJ, XI. Yeah. Yeah, this is another thing you can check. Oh yeah, maybe let me just go through this very quickly. So XI, YJ is like BI, X, CI, and YJ is like BJ, Y, CJ. So you could imagine you want to switch these two positions, right? So one way you can just move this guy twice from here to here, and there's no sign, right, so far. And you can also, after that, you're gonna flip this C from here and to here, right? So you also do twice swapping, so there's no sign introduced. The reason being, and the difference between this K is that the C here, they are equal, right, at the same side. But C here, they are at a different side, so there's no minus one sign introduced here. Yeah.
Peter, sorry. A couple of questions. So on every link, where I have 2BX or just 1BX? Like one per site or?
That's right. So for every link, you're going to have 2BX.
Okay.
Yeah. And they belong to different vertices.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
And what is the relation between the Bs and Cs to the gammas? I miss.
Oh, sorry. So, yeah. There's no particular relation, just that here is a review, Latin review for Mariana fermions. Yeah, so just because gamma is the conventional notation people use for. Yeah, this is a review for Mariana fermions. Yeah, but I'm using some specific notation for Mariana fermion here. Yeah, right. And let me say the last thing. B Mariana fermions and C Mariana fermions, they are not independent from each other.
But is there a motivation for the BC notation? Because, I mean, the way I now understood it, those four map to gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, gamma 4, yeah? Like you're just changing notation.
Sure. Oh, yeah, so I guess the difference is that, this is just a change of notation. Yeah, but... Yeah, but indeed, as I was just gonna mention right now, there's some relation between B and C fermions, and that is because you introduce some, because you want to map to the original physical Hilbert space, so you're gonna introduce some constraint for those fermions. Yeah, and this is the thing I'm gonna explain right now. And that property will make a difference between this conventional Mariana fermion, because conventionally, when you say, okay, you have four Mariana fermions, there's no relation between gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, and gamma 4. Yeah. I mean, in addition to the algebra. But if I consider at least four Mariana fermions, there are some constraints of those fermions so that you can map the operator to the physical Hilbert space. And the reason being, if you consider X, Y, Z, the product of those spin operator, right? That is gonna be equal to I, the imaginary unit. Yeah. And on the other hand, you also know that for each operator, there's a corresponding representation in terms of Marana fermions, right? So you're going to have, for example, Rx will be equal to I BxC, and then you're going to have Y from the contribution from Y, then that is I ByC, and then you have the contribution from Z, so that's going to give you I BzC. Yeah. And let me just massage you a little bit. Yeah, and you'll find that in order to satisfy the conventional algebra in the physical Hilbert space, you need to set this guy to be one. So this is a constraint for those Marana fermions, so they are not independent from each other. Only when you do this projection, only when you infer this constraint, then the operator can be identified as the sum operator in the spin of physical Hilbert space. Yeah. And indeed, so right now, indeed, you can just from the dimensional counting, you know that this should be the constraint for those fermions because you start from four Marana, right? And that is basically equal to two complex fermions. Yeah, and what is the dimension formed by two complex fermions? That is basically you have two fermionic mode. So then for each mode, you can either fill a fermion or not. So you get two times two to be four, right? So if you now naively just introduce unsized four Marana fermions, the Hilbert space, unsigned Hilbert space is equal to 4. But then you know that it's not right because the physical Hilbert space unsigned is equal to 2. And so only when you infer this, indeed this is a constraint so that, you know, you should use 4 divided by 2 to get 2. If you infer this constraint, the dimension will be reduced to 2, right? So this is another way to see that there must be some constraint for those Marana fermions. Yeah, so right now let's try to use these Marana fermions to try to solve for the ground state, try to solve for the Hamiltonian. Yeah, this is the Hamiltonian you start with, right? So some of all the links, but of course this is a shorthand notation because the Kij, this operator, it could be XS or YY or ZZ depending on orientation of this link. And J corresponding Jij is just the corresponding coupling constant. But this is the form of the Hamiltonian we start with. Yeah, all right, so let's try to understand how to write down the Kij. Yeah, so Kij is the product of two spin operators belong to neighboring different spin sites, right? So by that, from that we can write down, it's gonna be equal to some B, Let me write down answer and I'll explain. Yeah, so say Kij is the coupling along x direction, right? It's gonna be some I BIX times C, that is the Pauli X operator at the site I, and this is gonna be the Pauli X operator at the site J, right? So yeah, but right now I just write down to be the subscript alpha. So alpha could be X or Y or Z, yeah, depending on orientation of the IJ link, right? Yeah. So let me massage you a little bit. So just imagine you want to group this BI, BJ together. So specific what happens. So imagine you have a site. There are two sites here, right? It is the X link. So there's a C fermions here, and CJ fermions here. And for a given spin that is site, they're gonna associate with some B operator, right? Yeah, so for example, this is the X link, so there's gonna be some, you know, BIX operator here, right? And there's gonna also be a BJX operator here, right? Yeah. So by this, it is simply the part of these four Majorana fermions along the X direction. Yeah. And right now, a feature you notice is all right, so you could code this to be some, you know, Uij operator. All right. So at a first glance, it is a complicated problem, right? Because the Hamiltonian is a part of four. The local term is a part of four Majorana fermions. That basically means that the Hamiltonian is an iterating model, right? Only because non-iterating because it's a part of, you know, four fermions. And so this is different from if you consider some free fermion non-iterative model, you get a quadratic term, right, in the Hamiltonian. Yeah, so it is a strongly iterative model, so at first glance, it's not easy to solve. But so here's the interesting part. So let me identify this part of B, in other words, the part of B to be some operator Uij. And then what you find is that this Uij operator, it commutes with the Hamiltonian. And they also commute with each other. Yeah. So basically, let me try to draw some figure to explain this. So on every vertex, there's a C Majorana fermions, right? There's a C Majorana fermions. And there's gonna be some, the product of B. Yeah, you know what I mean. So on every side, there are some C Majorana fermions. And on the link, there are some associated, you know, B Majorana fermions, right, in different orientation. But right now, the point is that this operator will commute with each other, and they commute with the Hamiltonian. So you may as well just choose some this Uij to be some number. Which is, you know, plus or minus one. Yeah. And the reason why they commute with the Hamiltonian is because, say, you consider some local term here. It is like BI, BJ, So of course, it's going to commute with the product of four Mylar fermions here, right? Because it appeared twice. But then this is like a product of two Mylar fermions. So you're going to commute with every other thing as well, right? Because they don't overlap. Yeah. So this is a conserved quantity, and you can just replace this operator by some plus or minus one sign. And if you do that, that is very nice, because when you plug in this to be some number, this is a quadratic problem for C fermions, and which we know how to solve. Yeah, so right now the story is kind of simple. When you plug in this operator to be plus or minus one sign, you can just solve for the ground state of the those C fermion problem. You solve for the ground state for those C fermions. All right, so you get a state. And then that also means that the structure for those free fermion state is like you have some state of in terms of C fermions. And then because you assign those operator to form a dimer, right? Originally it is a product of two B Mylar fermions. And then when you plug in that to be some plus or minus one sign, that means those fermions form a dimer. And that is some free fermion state as well, labeled by B. So tensor product between these two things. All right, and this is the thing you can solve. But this is not the physical ground state because you need to infer the constraints to group those B and C fermions together, right? So the physical ground state labeled by psi, that would be equal to you infer the on-site constraints. And then you act on that free fermion state. So this is the framework for solving this ground state of the Hamiltonian. Yeah. Any questions so far?
Can I see if I understand what's going on? So you started from these IEV Onicom and with the X and Ys, and then you kind of split the operators X and Ys and Z, CB's product, and then you recombine them in a smarter way.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have these U's that are combinations of the B's that commute with everything, and therefore you just assign to them some value, which becomes, so you have your big Hilbert space is now split into sectors, and in each of these sectors, you look at an effective Hamiltonian for the C's, and now you solve it for the C's in every sector.
Yes, okay. Yes, exactly, yeah, exactly right, yeah.
So how do you compare the ground state of and any configuration of them, or each
of them? Oh yeah, that's a good question. So I haven't told you what is the value of U I should choose to minimize the ground state energy. Yeah. So that is gonna be the thing right now. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. Otherwise, we don't know what is the ground state to minimize the energy, right? So, yeah. But before that, so let me mention a few words. So basically, the physical ground state is satisfied maybe I should write down this. Right? any physical states must satisfy this algebra so that it can be regarded as a state in the spin Hilbert space, right? And so basically, let me just make some comments. So the Poisson constraint, which is this guy, to be one. It can be regarded as an imposing sum z to Gauss law. And the Uij is some z2 gauge field. And the unsigned constraint can also be can be regarded as doing some gauge transformation. Now, so by that, let me explain what I mean here. Say on a given site, there are some associated neighboring B, right? And it is gonna can be connected to different sites like this, right? So say you consider the U. If you consider this a U, the gauge field, the thing we introduced here, is a part of B fermions. When you write down this U, and then what does it do for this DI? So this DI is the product of operator around this region, right? So that means this DI anti-commutes with the value of the product of B here. So So if you specify the operator value for uij, then under this transformation, you are gonna keep a minus one sign here. So that means the value of uij is not a gauge invariant quantity. The value itself is not a physical thing to consider, right? Because ground state satisfies the di to be one, and then you find out some operator get a minus one sign under this transformation. So that means it's gonna vanish in the physical subspace, right? So you need to consider some gauge invariant quantity, and now become a physical thing to consider. So only thing that can happen for the physical Hilbert space are those gauge invariant quantity. Gauge invariant mean in the sense that you transform trivially under this DI operator, right? And one choice is the one thing you notice is that the reason why the product B transform non-trivially under this unsigned constraint because they touch once here. So one way to get around that is you consider the product of Manuela dimers around a plaquette, right? Then they form a closed loop. And this is a gauge invariant quantity, meaning that if this guy conjugated by any on-site unitary, then it transforms trivially, right? Then and one reason to see it, one thing to notice is because it is a part of this B here around this plaquette. If you consider a local gauge transformation here, you're gonna get a minus one sign here, and also get a minus one sign here. So and they cancel. So it is it transforms trivially under DJ operator, right? And indeed, you may want to check what is the physical meaning of this. Right, so as I just mentioned, it's the product of some link of the gauge field around this parquet, right? And as it turns out, it is equal to the product of an interaction term in Hamiltonian in the spin model language. Yeah. So only when you consider this a product of U, that can be understood as some product of a physical operator, this a Kij. And that is also the parquet operator, right, we had before. Yeah. Those are considered charges. And based on the analogy to the Z2 gauge theory, you may also call this to the Wilson loop. Right. Only those quantities that can, which can have some non-zero expression value in the physical subspace, right? And another gauge invariant thing is in addition to the closed loop operators, you can also allow the loop to be open in some cases. So you're gonna find some operator that is invariant under the gauge transformation. And the other way is this. You have some U operator here, 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 right? The part of those B Mariana fermions. And then when I consider this kind of string operator, if I attach this product by C fermion here and a C fermion here, then it is also a gauge invariant quantity, right? And one way to see that is just because certainly it transforms trivially if you consider the on-site constraint anywhere, right? Any other places. And if you consider this guy, right? You add twice, so you get the minus one sign squared to one, it cancels trivially. Yeah. And also the same thing happened here, right? Yeah. So this is another thing you can consider, the gauge invariant operator. Only this operator and that operator can be mapped, can be understood as a spin operator in the physical space. Yeah. And why do I mention about this? It is because there are some redundancy about the choice of which ij you choose to solve for the ground state, right? So as we mentioned before, the value for uij, it doesn't matter. What matters is the product of uij around the loop, right? And the value and that value will determine the energy for the physical space. So, yeah. So right now, so given this, we should only just focus on what kind of configuration of the Wilson loop can minimize the energy.
Peter?
Yeah.
So you now have reinterpreted the model with the U's and the C's in terms of a classical gauge field, a classical lattice gauge theory with with some matter at the vertices.
Yeah.
But the U's are classical essentially, right? Because they commute with everything. Or they do not commute with the C's. Like, is there some, am I missing?
Oh yeah, so when I write down U originally, it is an operator. It's a product of some operator. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you consider that the transformation rule for that operator under the gauge transformation, it do transform non-trivially given that it is an operator. Yeah. So it is a gauge theory. Yeah. So
Is a Z2 lattice gauge theory with fermions at the vertices?
Yeah. Right. I think that's the right way to interpret this model, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, thanks for the question. All right, so right now let's go back to what kind of configuration can minimize the ground state. So there's a result by Leib saying that, you know, given this kind of model, yeah, which I'm gonna talk about in details. So given this model, you choose the vertex-free configuration, and that can minimize the ground state. By vertex free, Yeah. So by vertex-free configuration, it means that only when the value for WP to be equal to 1, then the ground state will lie in that sector. Yeah. So in order to find the ground, physical ground states, the one that minimizes the energy, right? You just go to that sector specified by every WP to be 1, and then you can solve for the ground state. Yeah. And this is also very nice because if you consider that sector, right, you know that ground state is satisfied in that sector. You may as well just choose every Uij to be 1, right? This is a trivial way to satisfy that constraint. So if you choose every Uij to be 1, yeah, then you can just straightforwardly solve for the ground, the problem for C fermions. Yeah. So there are many calculations in the reference by Kitayev, but yeah, let me just write down the result for you. Yeah, so basically, if you already plug in every U to be 1, you can solve for the ground state in terms of these C fermions, right? And then, because there are some translation symmetry, so you can just do the Fourier transform to solve for the ground state. And that will be written by, you know, you have you have a label Q, that label the lattice momentum, and you have a corresponding single particle energy. Yeah, so, and by this, I mean, it is the complex fermion. Yeah, so anyway, the bottom line is, for any quadratic problem for fermions, that can always be diagonalized into this kind of form. So, and this is a complex fermions. And so basically, when you write down this form, that means you already diagonalize the Hamiltonian because you know the ground state, you know every state, you can just feel, you know, when you start from the vacuum for AQ, just when you add the operator, and then you can create the corresponding energy associated with that single particle occupation number, right? Yeah, it's a standard things. So right now, let's try to analyze the structure of this energy spectrum. So you find that it kind of depends on the original coupling constant in the Hamiltonian. Yeah, so if all the coupling constants, they are kind of close to each other, they are not too far away from each other, that means that, and in that case, you can find some gapless mode. So that means that at some lattice momentum, the single particle spectrum is gonna be zero. And yeah, let me skip many details, but basically that means that in the momentum space, you know, it is a two-dimensional real space, right? So the momentum space will also be two-dimensional. And this is like Qx, this is Qy, the momentum it along different directions. And what you find is that at some location, you are gonna have something like a Dirac cone.
Peter?
Yeah?
I have a question just regarding the during the Fourier transform.
All right.
I know, like, on the honeycomb, you have, and you said that it's gapless, so you have two different values, right?
Which has two different values?
In the momentum space. Spectrum should be two level.
Spectrum should be two level. Can you say a bit more about?
Okay. Yeah, so essentially the idea is that like you have gapless fermions at each vertex, right?
So when I write down this, it's a general thing. It doesn't rely on whether this is gapless or not, right? That you agree.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But once you have, whether it's gapless depends.
Oh, yeah. So when So Hamiltonian depends on original coupling constant for spin, right? So that is determined by Jx, Jy, Jz. And I'm saying I want to analyze the spectrum for those single particle excitation. Yeah? And I find that it can be either be gapless or gapped, depending on the value of these coupling constants. And when this coupling constant satisfies this condition, I get some gapless excitation. And the spectrum I'm gonna write down right now. I'm gonna draw for you.
So
depends on whether what is value for this, it can either be gapped or gapless.
But regardless, you have fermions.
Regardless, you have fermions.
Yeah, but the honeycomb lattice only have threefold symmetry. Around each unit cell, you have six fermions, basically. You have threefold symmetry, so that reduces like your degree.
You said what's threefold degeneracy? So
threefold rotation.
Oh yeah, so.
So in momentum space, you similarly do the same. You have the Brouwer zone, which is another, right? And you can use the threefold degree of freedom that you have in the Brouwer zone too.
Sure.
Of the Brouwer zone?
Sure, Yeah.
But again, that covers two valleys or gapless points if.
Oh yeah, that's right. So there are two gapless points.
Yeah.
So and that I haven't mentioned yet. Thank you. Yeah. But so right now some in the momentum space. Yeah, indeed there are two gapless points. But and one point is, let me use a different color. Wait, it's a bit messy here. This is Qs, the moment, lattice momentum along x, and you're gonna have a Qy. And there's a corresponding energy single particle excitation spectrum. So this is gonna be some single particle energy, yeah. And what you find is that at some point, you're gonna have some Dirac cone like this. Yeah, so those are the negative energy mode. So you could imagine the ground state will already be occupied. And above there's some, anyway, the main point is that here it is gapless. So it means that the energy spectrum, the energy gap between the ground state and the first excited state, the gap will scale like a 1 over L. So it vanishes in thermodynamic limits. So that's what we mean by gapless. And this happened for this kind of parameter region. And there's another region. And by the way, so this is a Dirac cone. And as you already mentioned, so there's another point where you also have a Dirac cone, so you can impair. But we won't say much about that. But right now, let me discuss a different phase. So there's a nice way to draw the phase diagram for all the parameter region. And this is one way. So let's consider Jx plus Jy to be Jz to be one. And they are individually non-negative. So basically, when you consider this configuration in the parameter space, it is like a simplex, right? And so basically what you find is that inside this triangle, it is gapless. So basically, in particular, this point means jx equal to jy equal to jz, which is the isotropy limit, right? And this is one particular point that respect this condition, right? So in this entire region, you get a gapless spectrum where you have some, you know, Dirac cone here. And here for this three region, you get a gapped Z2 topological order. In particular, in this anisotropy limit, you could use the degenerate perturbation theory, and you can really see that, okay, under perturbation theory, you can recover the Kitaya torical model, and that supports the gap Z2 topological order. So and here is what people call the gap region is what people call the gap A phase, and the gapless regime is called the B phase, but it's just a name. The essential feature is that depending on the parameter, the coupling constant in Hamiltonian, it could either support some gapless mode or some gap excitation. And when for the gap phase, you recover the conventional topological order that you are familiar with. But non-trivial thing is you can also have some gapless excitation in some parameter region. So here, it is not a well-defined topological order because it is gapless. But it is some interesting state of matter, you know, like spin liquid, gapless spin liquid, if you like, because spin doesn't order here. But because it is gapless, it doesn't support a truly true topological order. And I guess I have 10 minutes, so let me consider different things. So we know that in some region, it supports like a, you know, torical like Z2 topological order. And the non-trivial thing is right now, even though in this parameter region, it is gapless, but we can open a gap if you consider some time reversal symmetry breaking perturbation. Yeah, so say you consider some unsized, you know, perturbation that break the time reversal symmetry. The reason why you break time reversal symmetry is just because you can imagine this is like an unsized, you know, magnetic field, right, along different direction. Yeah, so when you do a time reversal operation, you can flip the sign, right? So this guy is not invariant under time reversal symmetry. And what happens is that if you consider this kind of perturbation, again, you can, already erase, but you can still, you know, plug in those part of B dimers to be one. You solve for some free fermion ground state. Yeah. So basically, it still takes this kind of form. There's a, you know, hopping like neighboring. So not necessarily neighboring, but it's the hopping between C fermion at different sites. And there are some kernel that specify how they hops. And in the presence of this local perturbation, what you find is maybe let me skip this part. Yeah, so under the presence of this time reversal symmetry breaking term, there are some pattern about the hopping, and Aij specify how fermion hop at the different sites. And in those cases, what we find is that you can still diagonalize the Hamiltonian to this kind of form. But right now, there's gonna be some dramatic change for the spectrum. So in particular, for the B phase, you're gonna open a gap So roughly speaking, this is the spectrum. That's QX. This is QY. This is the energy. You're going to open a gap. And this delta, roughly speaking, increase as the function of perturbation strength. Yeah, so you're gonna open a gap, and that's kind of interesting. So basically, if you try to understand better about the band structure about this excitation, you realize that the band structure is basically the same as the so-called P plus IPY superconductor. I probably don't have time to say more about the PS power PI power PY superconductor, but there are some interesting features. So basically, one thing is that the spectrum supports a chain number, non-zero chain number. And it can be one or minus one depends on the sign of this, depends on orientation of this, depends on chirality of the field you apply. Yeah. So basically, whenever you have some non-zero chain number, roughly speaking, the physical picture is that even though it is gap in the bulk, right? So it doesn't support any energy currents because it's a bulk, it's hard to propagate. Yeah. But the picture you should have in mind is there's an energy gap in the bulk, but there are some gapless mode on the boundaries. And they can carry some boundary currents, and that can transport some energy. Yeah. So even though, so bulk is kind of, it's not very interesting, but there are some interesting boundary mode that can carry some currents, energy current around the boundaries. So that's an interesting thing. So the first thing is, this is a Fermionic spectrum, right? So of course it supports the fermion excitation. And the second thing is, this is only one way to excite the energy, right, for the Hamiltonian. Another way is, I guess I already erased. Another way is you can try to introduce some vertex to increase the energy, right? So remember previously when we tried to solve for the ground state, we just set the Poincaré operator to be one, right? Because we know that is a sector where you can find a ground state. So another way to consider excitation is you just introduce some, you just try to flip the sign for some parquet, right? So, and when you consider that is called the vertex. So when you consider WP to be minus one, that is another way to introduce the excitation. And here you find a gapped vortices. Yeah, so there are two different kind of excitations here. And let me just summarize some of the important features about these vortices excitations. So basically, imagine you have some 2D lattice, and at some point, you introduce the vertex excitation here. Oops. Right? So given this vertex excitation, you can still try to understand, okay, what is the band structure about these C fermions, right? It's a free fermion problem. And what you'll find is that this vertex will try to bind some interesting Marana zero mode. So basically, by this, I mean that around this region, around this vertex excitation, you can also consider some, you can define some gamma p operator. And it is gonna be the linear combination of the C fermions. But anyway, it is an operator. And it gonna be some, it is a Majorana fermion in the sense that, okay, the dot gamma p is equal to gamma p dagger, just satisfy the convention of Majorana fermions. And it is a zero mode in the sense that it commutes with the Hamiltonian. And that's why we call the Majorana zero mode. What is the consequence? That means if you have two vertices, you have two associated Majorana zero mode. And then you can define, you know, you could imagine you define some complex fermion. Right? And then you can use this, you know, imagine you have some eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And then this property means that when I try to occupy this compressed fermion mode, because F fermion is composed by two, you know, Majorana fermions, right? And fermion, this guy commute with the Hamiltonian, meaning it's the definition for the Majorana zero mode. And the reason, and the consequence is that you can swap these two guys, right? Yeah. Say you have some state where this compressed fermion mode is not occupied, and this is the corresponding eigenstate equation, right? And then imagine you want to occupy that mode with some, you want to occupy some single fermion in that compressed fermion mode. So you apply with some F dagger, and you try to measure the energy using Hamiltonian, right? And because these two guys commute, so you get back to itself, right? So you find that this guy and this guy, they have the same energy, right? And this is a consequence of this Majorana zero mode. So zero mode basically means that if you actually occupy that mode, it doesn't cause any extra energy, right? So basically there are two different things. So first thing is that we have fermion excitation. And the second thing is when you can also consider some gap vertex excitation. And that has an interesting consequence that it binds to some Majorana zero mode. So for this, let me just summarize what we have right now. So the feature is that we find a feature for non-abelian theory, right? So basically you have one, which is the vacuum, and sigma and epsilon. This is the Majorana fermions associated with this gap vertex excitation. Then you can also have some fermion excitations. And in particular, this is non-abelian because when you put two Majorana fermions together, they form a complex mode, which can be occupied or not. So there are two possibilities that doesn't necessarily fuse to some particular outcome, right? So that is interesting features for this non-abelian theory. So right now, let me say the last thing about this, the consequence of these Majorana fermions. You can really find that when you try to swap or try to bred two Majorana fermions, you'll introduce some unitary matrices. That is a non-trivial thing compared to abelian theory. So consequence of Majorana zero mode. So basically imagine you want to create two Majorana fermion mode. So let's consider some reference here. Say this is the first location, you have some Majorana zero mode labeled by one. And there's another location with another Majorana zero mode labeled by two. So we need to be careful here. So when you write down the Marin operators, it is not a gauge invariant operator because it's a part of C fermions. So you need to attach by a string so that it is a gauge invariant quantity in the physical Hilbert space. Yeah, so basically, let me label by the path by L1, the path by L2. So this is what I mean by having the Marana zero mode here. You know, you have some Marana zero mode here, but it is not a gauge invariant quantity. So let's try to find a reference here so that it is a gauge invariant thing, right? And you can do the same thing for the second Marana fermion. Yeah. And right now, let's see what happens if you exchange the position between 1 and 2. Yeah, so you could imagine one way to exchange is this is the reference point. Sorry. Yeah, so you could imagine start from some 2 Marana zero mode here. When I do exchange, one way to do that is just because you can smoothly, you know, move gamma 1 from this path to adiabatically continue to this path, level by L1 prime, right? And for the other thing, you could imagine the gamma 2s go around in the path like this, right, and come back to here. So basically, when you can imagine there's a process given by the R matrix, which is a unitary matrix that implement this transformation, the swapping. And the action given by this R matrix is this. Yeah, so basically you start from some of the first Marana fermions along this path. You could imagine when you try to do the swapping for position, it is conjugated by some unitary operator R, so that you can adiabatically continue L1 to L1 prime, right? And because L1 prime is the original path operator around along this direction, so it is equal to WL2. And another thing is, let's say O is some reference point in the vertices. So there's a corresponding C fermions here. Yeah, so it is a C fermion, and this is also a combination of C fermions, and they are connected by some operator in between. Yeah, so that it is a gauge invariant quantity that we can consider. Yeah. Yeah, so this is the last thing. So basically, you could imagine when you do the swapping, right? You do some unitary transformation acting on this W2 operator, and you are going to continue to W2 prime. And as it turns out, let me just write down the result. Yeah, so basically when you can imagine you and it did continue the path from here to here, right? But then you want to bring it back to the original fermions. And one way to see that is that, so you could imagine you want to deform this path from this path to this path. And then you find out they differ by the product of the entire loop that includes the vertex here, right? So they differ by this. And because you know that the path includes a vertex here, so the product of U, which is the Wilson loop, around this region must be minus one. Yeah. So eventually you get a minus one sine L1. So to summarize, it's just that when you do the braiding, when you exchange the position between two particles, you realize a unitary matrix such that you get a minus one sign here, and you find that this guy needs to be written by this kind of form. Yeah. So in other words, this is different from the abelian anions. Yeah, so maybe there are many details here, but you can find all this, everything in the original paper. But the main thing is that when you exchange these two positions, you realize that basically means that you secretly already implement a unitary transformation, which is given by this R matrix. And it is a unitary, right? It is some operator. It is not some trivial phase vector. So in other words, when you exchange the position between two particles, you do realize some interesting unitary that can add non-trivially in the state you consider. So that makes a distinction between non-abelian anions and the abelian anions, right? In the abelian anions, you can only get a phase. But right now, when you do the braiding, you really implement some interesting non-trivial unitary operation in the state you consider. So that's, I guess, let's conclude the lecture. So I guess I will see you guys in the afternoon in the tutorial session. But I hope this lecture can be useful for you. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have John Donoghue's lectures at 11, so I don't want to go, I still would like to give you 10, 15 minutes of break at least, but we still have time for one or two quick questions if there are any. So the question was about experimental applications of this.
Implement, or you mean experimentally? Mm-hmm. So there's a good reference about by Jason Alicia, where it is basically a review paper where he summarized many basic ideas about Mariana zero mode. Why do we care about that? How can we do quantum computing by braiding those Mariana zero mode? And he also discussed some proposal about how to experimentally find in those zero mode. Sure. Yeah, that is a very nice review paper. I hope I get the name right, but the title is like some new pursuits in Mariana fermions. It's a review paper. It's a famous review paper. So just type this name and type Mariana fermions. It should pop up.
Okay, I think I'll keep my questions for this afternoon so we can get John set up. Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you.